From a threat perspective, I think one of the biggest things that we have going now, and this is obviously in every sort of sector, is the use of generative AI. Mm-hmm. So what we're seeing a lot in social media now is instead of just random accounts that might be controlled by a person or two, what you're seeing is hundreds and hundreds of bot accounts that are able to push forward a large amount of information very quickly.
You're listening to the ISF Podcast for your organization's better cybersecurity. Your host, ISF CEO Steve Durbin, is an expert in leadership, business culture transformation, and cyber strategies for today's top enterprises. I'm producer Tavia Gilbert. In today's episode, Steve sits down with Paul Bartel, a senior intelligence analyst with Peak Metrics. Paul was previously with the Defense Intelligence Agency, and he speaks with Steve about his experience working in government, how the public and private sectors can cooperate more effectively, and what businesses can do to protect themselves from misinformation campaigns.
Paul, thank you very much indeed for coming over today to join me on the podcast. Great to see you.
Great to see you. Thank you for having me.
Now, you've had a really interesting career. So you're an intelligence analyst. You've worked at the Defense Intelligence Agency. You're now in private sector. Tell us a little bit about what your job actually entails. What does an intelligence analyst do?
So when I was with the Defense Intelligence Agency, I actually spent about just under a decade at CENTCOM, working as a regional analyst as well a lot in the kinetic side of things with the targeting and things like that. I was also a senior executive briefer. So that meant I would deal a lot with General McKenzie or General Carrilla, providing them with different levels of information. So for 7 years there, a lot of what I did was looking at prioritizing your critical threats and things like that, making sure that I was giving them the best information that they needed to actually make these sort of national security level decisions that often involve life and death. A lot of what goes on with being an intelligence analyst isn't necessarily giving them all of the information. It's figuring out what do they actually need to make those decisions.
Right.
And then on top of that, how are you presenting that information? So if you're working with General McKenzie, he likes his stuff a lot more formal. He likes to get a formal product, sit down with them, go through it. He says, yes, good to go, or he'll have questions. Mm-hmm. General Carrilla, on the other hand, he might be more of the type that wants to just sit down and have a conversation. He might look at your report, be like, all good, great, but let's just talk this out. And so that's a lot. You have to be able to pivot in terms of how you're presenting the information. And then when you present that information, the most important thing about being an intelligence analyst and the hardest thing is you have to be honest.
Right.
So sometimes you might have to say, hey, our operations aren't having the effect that you think that they're actually having. And that can be very difficult for a lot of people to say. At the end of the day, though, they end up appreciating it a lot because that's the sort of information that they use to actually modify what we're doing. So we've taken that approach with Peak Metrics, and I came on about 7 months ago there, to start working with government customers looking at the information environment. So we take large amounts of data, whether they be tweets, Telegram posts, news articles, and we apply an LLM to that to be able to identify what narratives exist in those spaces. So for our different customers, we're using the same approach of identifying what's actually a critical narrative to them, and then also presenting that in an honest fashion, and also adjusting how we might be messaging. Even though we might be working with combatant commands who have a lot of overlay in terms of how they're looking at stuff, they might just want something in a different product format, which could be we want to look more at these threats, but it could also just be like we want it in this color. So a lot of it is touching base, getting that analytic feedback loop to say, here's what we found. Do you like what you're seeing? How can we tailor it to better support you?
And how have things changed, so from a threat perspective?
From a threat perspective, I think one of the biggest things that we have going now, and this is obviously in every sort of sector, is the use of generative AI. So what we're seeing a lot in social media now is instead of just random accounts that might be controlled by a person or two, what you're seeing is hundreds and hundreds of bot accounts that are able to push forward a large amount of information very quickly. So if we see a threatening narrative come out, we might actually be able to detect that 35% of this narrative that's derogatory towards the United States, that's actually controlled by bot accounts. So we're looking at how far is that narrative getting, which is getting further now because of all the generative AI and the amount of information that they can put out.
And where is most of this coming from?
So really three sources, I would say. If we're looking at the U.S. landscape, we have our conspiracy theorists that just love to push those conspiracy theories and sort of believe in whatever they want to.
Right.
Then you also have bipartisan actors who may want to push a certain narrative that's more favorable to their political candidate. We also have foreign adversaries, so Russia, China, Iran. Those are three big players in there. North Korea is also in there. And you also do have some other international organizations or, you know, sort of nefarious criminal organizations that might be pushing narratives for whatever reason they see fit.
And how are the public responding to some of this information that's out there? You know, would you say that the general user of, say, X or Facebook or whatever has become a lot more savvy about how to read between the lines? Or do you still think it's just sucking up information and...
So it's still sucking up a lot of information and a lot of people's attention. But I do think that we're, as a public, getting better about detecting the misinformation, or at least understanding that some of the information that we're reading is coming from actors who have more sinister intentions. So when we look at 2020, George Floyd protests, COVID and things like that, we just saw so much misinformation. And really the only people that understood that that was misinformation or even disinformation were isolated to these sort of pockets of experts and things like that, people that we're actually looking at, as compared to the 2024 elections, where, yes, there was a lot of misinformation, there was a lot of disinformation, but the public was also tracking, hey, there's people putting stories out. And so when you see something like Russian bomb threats at different election centers and things, the public was already knowledgeable to the extent that that might not be real. And then additionally, we also saw a lot of our local organizations put out, that's not a real threat. Mm-hmm. That's not something that's going on. You do need to come out to vote.
Right. And you mentioned briefing the generals there. I mean, presumably these are people that are used to what I would call traditional combat, traditional warfare. How difficult has it been to get them to make the jump to understand the role that digital has to play?
So when General Carrillo came on to CENTCOM, he wanted to be the command where they were truly focused on innovation. So really, actually, he's been more of a focal point there in terms of the command needs to switch over to appreciate how much the landscape outside of the DOD is changing and start to bring in those capabilities. I think he rightly has the correct interpretation that our adversaries are using this technology. They're using AI. They've been using it for years. They're putting this stuff out on a massive basis. We need to figure out how we can actually use that AI to actually combat that AI at the same time. There's a lot of other commands as well, too, that are really excited about integrating these sort of AI features into their own work sets. I think where the challenges you might see come on is because of the way that the security systems and the analytic systems within DOD are, it can be very hard to get some of that, these new tools, onto something like NIPR, which is your unclassified stuff, something like SIPR, which is your secret level. And then you have your JWICS, which is your top secret level. So how do you actually get through the bureaucracy, do the acquisitions process, and actually get them these new tools that will enable them to be able to respond to the AI threats that are out there?
Mm. And you're now in the private sector.
Yes. Right?
So how much collaboration exists between private sector and government in these sorts of areas?
So it's increasing. It's definitely, we're a few years behind where I think we need to be successful. But what you do see now is partnerships with a combatant command in Peak Metrics, several of them actually. And what we're doing is bringing that knowledge of, hey, we have these great engineers and these really innovative thinkers that had developed this tool set. How do we apply that to it? What we hear a lot from the combatant commands or other military organizations or any really government organization is that they know we're losing the information fight, but they can't really find a way to quantify it. They just kind of have their finger in the ground. They're going, it seems like we're losing this. What we're able to do is provide them with the way to actually quantify what's going on and actually say this narrative that's saying that CENTCOM is behaving in a poor way in the Middle East for whatever reason, here's actually how far that's getting. Here's where it's coming from. Here's how rapid it's accelerating, or actually, you know, it might be dissipating as well too. So those are the areas where you're starting to see cooperation. And I think that as the technology and as more people within the intelligence community get a little bit more comfortable with some of the AI techniques, you'll start to see that integrated more into U.S. defense mechanisms.
Mm. Now, one of the things that certainly law enforcement has complained about for years is that they obviously know where some of these attacks or misinformation, you know, is coming from, but they're not able to do anything about it because they're in countries that don't have extradition arrangements with the United States, with Europe, and so on. Where do you think we could improve in terms of the level of collaboration that exists perhaps within the United States and then indeed outside with some of the NATO partners?
Well, part of the problem, I think, with social media is that you can really go on and say whatever you want. So the biggest thing I think that needs to start happening is the social media companies really especially need to take accountability for their own clientele base that might be spreading the misinformation. Mm-hmm. we have, you know, mechanisms and tools in place now where we can identify the accounts that are actually spreading the misinformation. But that's where we need to be able to give that information to the social media corporations and say, here is this list of 1,200 accounts that we've identified that are pushing terrorist propaganda on your platform. You need to deplatform those accounts. Mm-hmm. In addition, another thing that I think that needs to happen is the counter messaging that we're having. When we see them come out with a message, what is it that we can say that actively counteracts that? So if we have a narrative of some sort that's saying the Gaza humanitarian pier is being built with rubble and bodies, and that's how the U.S. is building this thing. Well, first of all, say no, it's not. And then also provide evidence of how that's actually being constructed, because what you can see is it's very clearly a very modern structure that's not being built with rubble.
Mm. That's an interesting point, though, isn't it? Because, you know, once something is out on social media, it's out there forever, pretty much. So yes, you could deplatform, but you still got this data, this information that people are going to find that's out there. So it's not a case of just putting up something once to go against. It's an ongoing process, presumably.
Well, it's an ongoing process, and really, even if you're deplatforming all of these accounts, right, because you can create new emails. You can even use spoofing technology right now to go to the same email account and say, I want 1,000 spoof emails associated with this account. So in that regard, I mean, are you going to degrade it? No, you're going to disrupt it. Mm-hmm. But it's at least getting into that space of, okay, let's make it more challenging for them to be able to release all this on a consistent basis. When you're looking at information operations, it's not the same as doing a large kinetic strike, where you might be able to deliver a really effective message very quickly with a large amount of munitions. What you're looking at is more of a death by 1,000 cuts. Mm-hmm. And really, it's a death by 1,000 paper cuts. It's these little tiny victories that you have to constantly pursue and will always have to constantly pursue to be able to actually overcome or actually gain an advantage in the information environment.
What is sort of response is government getting from the social media platforms? I mean, are they on board with this? Or because the perception, I think, certainly from outside of the United States is that there needs to be more regulation. There needs to be more control. Social media platforms need to stand up and take accountability for some of these things. What's the view?
I mean, I think within DOD, and this is just speaking really anecdotally, is that, that we would like to see more participation from the social media platforms in terms of regulating those accounts, because they do undermine U.S. activities and partner activities throughout the world. Oftentimes, they're really oriented at trying to do the best thing in support of democracy or human rights. But there hasn't really been that huge drive, I don't think, yet in terms of these platforms will actually start to deplatform some of these activities. We've seen very large amounts of automated activity, which right there, that should automatically get rid of the platform. Something like Twitter, for example, or X now. If you have a user posting 700 times a day, that should just be flagged right there, no matter what they're actually posting about, because that's violating your terms of service, but you're not actually enforcing them. Mm. We do see limited amounts of, when we go through these automated accounts where we might have been doing a month-long research project of, oh, okay, some of these are suspended, but they might also just be deleted, so it might just be them covering their tracks. So there is an effort there, but it definitely needs to increase.
And let's take a look now at the private sector. So we've talked quite a bit about what goes on from a government standpoint. How concerned should large organizations be about this sort of misinformation?
I think they should be very largely concerned. So we do work with private sector firms as well. Mm-hmm. I fall more on the intelligence and foreign adversary type deal type of stuff. But a lot of these companies are really worried about these narratives that might emerge very early on that could be damaging. So you can have someone say something, let's say a firm is accused of having a CEO that's anti-Semitic or things like that. Whether or not that's true, the firm needs to identify that earlier on and have a plan of attack in place in order to combat that narrative. Or figure out, hey, can we actually take a look at what accounts are pushing this, and are they part of some sort of foreign adversary influence campaign, or are they also potentially just from people who are trying to undermine our business for whatever reason that they need? But because anyone can get onto social media or really generate a large amount of material through the new generative AI processes, they should be concerned, because if anyone doesn't want their business to do well, they can find a way to make it not do well.
But that to me sounds like a very expensive process.
Sounds like it, but that's, I think, one of the things where we're coming in and saying, okay, we can provide you with this tool. We have a platform that looks at all of these different mentions. Now, one of the reports that I do, for example, just getting through the amount of social media articles and news articles, done the math on it, would take me a year to get just organize that data.
Right.
Our generative process does that in about 2 hours.
Okay.
So I'm obviously be able to do a lot more with just one analyst. You're taking one analyst and turning them into almost an organization. It would take five analysts, we did the math on this too, 2 to 3 months. Mm-hmm. So that's really bringing that amount of resource down. And that's where even if there's an expense loaded into that in terms of you got to hire an analyst to do it or you need to pay for the platform, what you can do is completely magnify the amount of time or make it less time in order to be able to have your analysts get through that sort of stuff. The process there then is that instead of having some sort of report that looks like a master's thesis, is an analyst can do it in a day or two.
Right, okay. Now, one of the challenges that security people always talk to me about is trying to get across some of these messages to the business, particularly to the C-suite. Any sort of tips or advice on how they can do that based on, you know, your experience of briefing and working in this space for quite some while?
Where we've had a lot of success is just being able to show our work and getting into the platform and showing some of the ways that we have this group of stories that's in this narrative that's really kind of derogatory towards your firm, and then showing them, hey, this is what this is about. This is who's pushing it. Giving them the proof and not just the abstract, yeah, people are saying bad things about you. You need to actually be able to show them.
Mm-hmm. Let me sort of ask you what is probably an impossible question, but look forward for us 3-5 years out. How do you see things changing in this space?
So I have some cautious optimism, but
okay.
Things will get worse, right, at the same time, right? Because if we're looking at what the expert projection is, it's 90% of material online is going to be synthetically generated by 2026.
Right.
So that is a good thing and a bad thing, right? Because in some aspects, you have the good part of it where this could just be magnifying what an analyst can do to actually get after a problem set, or some researcher that's doing work on cancer and they have an outline and they want to turn that into an actual full report and they can oversee that. Even in the creative side of things, you could have some local musicians who need to create a logo for the band. Everything's being magnified, but the problem with that is that at the same time, our adversaries are going to use that magnifying capability to increase their productivity and get after us. They're not going to stop sort of coming at us from these different angles and generating more material and putting out more deep fakes or text-based content to try and malign the U.S. The advantage, though, I think that we have that we're starting to see is a larger partnership between the private and public sectors in terms of the private sector is developing a lot of these tools, and now the public sector is looking at how do they integrate those. Mm-hmm. And if we're able to successfully do that integration, I think we'll actually be able to combat the larger amount of misinformation that we're going to be headed towards.
And again, back to the private space. So what are the sorts of things that you think the C-suite, boards of directors should be doing in order to ensure that their companies are best placed to exist in the world that you've just described 2 to 3 to 5 years out?
Well, I think they need to be integrating those tools, whether that's they're developed organically by their own firms or they're working with a different vendor to ensure that they're able to track the information floating around about not only their company, but also what's going on in the information environment.
Mm-hmm.
I think early in the Gaza crisis, we saw a lot of companies not really understand how they should handle a lot of the information that was coming out. Do we fall pro-Israel? Do we fall pro-Gaza? Or do we have to manage some sort of in-between on that? And that's up to each company and their board of executives, but they can at least get a sense of, if I take this position, this is how I can expect to be received by the public. So just getting an early handle on what's being said about them and the information environment at large can help them navigate a lot of the challenges that we see in an information environment that's pushing out more and more information and can change on a minute-to-minute, hour-to-hour basis.
And presumably being ready for that. So, you know, running things like cyber simulation exercises, making sure that the state of preparedness is as high as possible, increasing the way in which they're going to respond to these sorts of things. Those are the sorts of things that immediately come to my mind anyway that they should be looking at.
Yeah, I think, you know, simulations are a great way. Case studies also, you know, if you've ever had a company, and we have seen a few in the last years that end up having these really massive brand reputation issues, whether due to some of their marketing and advertising or due to positions that their leadership has come out with. That, I think, to get those examples then gives them a case of, okay, this is what happened there. This is what we can take and learn from that.
Fantastic. Paul, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for shining a bit of a light on in certain areas that certainly our listeners probably wouldn't be able to look at normally. So it's been very interesting. Thank you very much indeed.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Our thanks to special guest, Paul Bartel. In the meantime, if you enjoyed today's episode, please take a moment to rate and review the podcast, and we'd be pleased if you'd consider sharing the episode. To become a member, get in touch with Steve directly at steve.durbin@securityforum.org or on LinkedIn. Check out all our media and resources. All of it is there to support you at securityforum.org. Don't miss our other podcast, Dear InfoSec, sharing conversations with members about the real-world applications of ISF research. The ISF podcast is produced by TalkBox Productions and Tavia Gilbert. Thanks for listening.